You may have received the message in the mail, with a stark photo of a needle next to an empty swing in a playground. The Tories play on fear. Their message seems simple and tempting. Getting tough is the way to deal with drugs. Bill C-15 is their latest incarnation of this tough-on-crime approach. One of the main things in Bill C-15 is more mandatory minimums for possessing drugs, including growing as few as 5 marijuana plants. Backed with a moral and ideological agenda, the reality of these get-tough approaches has particularly harsh impact on women. To help us explore Bill C-15 and this kind of drug policy and its impact on women, we have reached Susan Boyd. Susan's an activist, researcher, and writer on drug policy. She's a professor at the University of Victoria and has a special interest in the gendered implications of drug policy. In response to the Harper government's tough-on-crime measures, Susan has written, over a year span, 52 letters, one a week, to Stephen Harper, and she documented them on her website, educatingharper.com. Susan joins us on the phone from her home in Vancouver. Thanks for joining us, Susan, and helping us explore some of these issues.
Well, thanks for inviting me on the show.
Tell us a little bit about the main elements of this Bill C-15.
I think the important thing to think about in relation to Bill C-15 is that it's an act to amend our Controlled Drugs and Substance Act, and our Controlled Drugs and Substance Act is already quite harsh. You know, they do a pretty good job of criminalizing people for possession of drugs that are criminalized, like cocaine and heroin and cannabis, and we have pretty harsh maximum penalties for possession, trafficking, transporting, production of drugs in Canada. But what we do have is some discretion in relation to people's movement through the criminal justice system. So if a young person is arrested for a drug crime or a drug offense, the judge then has some discretion. They can take into account the circumstances of that offense. Was it a first offense? What are the particulars in the person's background? Those kind of things that they can consider. But with Bill C-15 and its predecessor, Bill C-26, the judge no longer has that type of discretion, because what this crime bill is advocating is what we call mandatory minimums. So if someone is arrested for growing 5 marijuana plants, let's say, they would receive a mandatory minimum of 6 months, and the judge would have no movement to make that a lesser sentence. And it's quite interesting, the mandatory minimums, because not only does it not allow for this type of discretionary powers by the judges, but we've also seen in the United States that from the 1970s to 1980s, they enacted mandatory minimums in many states. And what we have today is the largest prison population in the world, and more than 2 million people in prison, you know, as we speak. And there's a movement in the United States to actually, revise these laws, because they're seeing that they haven't done anything to lower illegal drug use or the production or the drug trade. And it hasn't made the United States any safer. And so the question is, why would we be introducing these types of mandatory minimums at this time, especially during a recession, because it will increase prison costs, divert, you know, precious resources to criminal justice where they could be used in better ways. And so that's just some of the some issues that are related to Bill C-15. But I think one of the very disturbing issues related to the bill is that there's a 2-year mandatory minimum if a drug crime is committed by a school or any public place frequented by people under 18. And so when you're thinking about a city like Vancouver, you know, there's schools in every area of the city. But also it would be very difficult to try to figure out, well, where is it that youth don't come together in the city? You know, where would that space be? So this law will definitely have a huge impact on youth, and youth who, you know, come together on the beach or in different places in the city. And it could have a terrible long-term impact on them to have to serve a mandatory minimum of 2 years.
And where is Bill C-15 in the parliamentary process? What are the chances of it passing into law?
Well, the chances are pretty high because it's actually the Liberal government supported the Conservatives in relation to this bill. It was only the Bloc and the NDP that opposed it. And so it's gone through its last reading, and now it would be the Senate that would possibly stop it. And, of course, if we had an election, that, you know, could stop it, because that's what occurred with Bill C-26. We had an election, so that bill just died on the floor. So if we have an election, it has to be resurrected again. And then there could be possibly a bit more opposition to it outside of the two parties that did oppose it. It was very disappointing. There were hearings in Ottawa about the bill, and most of the people that came to speak were opposed to mandatory minimums, made a very good case in relation to them, but the government just ignored them completely.
And how does this bill fit into the larger picture of conservative drug policy?
Well, I think we saw a radical shift the minute that the Conservatives, came into power. And one of the shifts that's occurred is sort of stripping social supports, getting hard on crime, you know, sort of looking to law as a solution to our social problems. And they created what we call anti-drug strategy. We had a national drug strategy in Canada, but the word anti all of a sudden, you know, was put in place once it was a conservative minority government. And it seems to me, if you look at what's been going on over the last couple of years, is that any social issue in society is seen as a law issue. So it's constantly going to the law, increasing police presence, police powers, harsher laws. And I think this just fits in with their law and order ideology, a very punitive perspective on how to work with people and society. And very, you know, if you want to look at it in a larger way and, you know, think that maybe we live in a social democracy, you have to ask the question, you know, how can you criminalize so many people in society? It's a question we ask in the United States all the time. If you have the highest prison population in the world, you know, how can that be? How can you call yourself a democracy? But I think we can ask similar questions in Canada. What kind of society do we want to live in? You know, we should reserve criminalizing activities, and especially prison, for offenses that we agree are damaging to society. And I don't think we have that kind of consensus when it comes to drug use in Canada. We can see from our last national drug survey that over 44% of adults have tried marijuana. And that drug is criminalized, except for a small percent of people that have are using it for medical marijuana purposes. So I don't know how you can really justify drug laws that are criminalizing almost half of the Canadian adult population. And that's quite disturbing. And when we look at the police-reported drug offenses in Canada that came out in 2007, we see what is similar to the year before and the year before that is that 6 out of 10 drug offenses are for cannabis, and 3/4 of those are for possession. So really what we're doing is arresting cannabis users, you know, and people who use other criminalized drugs. But when Harper and the Conservative Party talk about drugs, we would assume it's these high-level drug traffickers. It's people using what are considered to be more harmful drugs like cocaine and heroin. But when you look at the stats, that's not true. You know, who we arrest are cannabis users and very poor, visible, low-level users and sellers on the street. And the mandatory minimums are going to, that will make no difference in terms of who will be arrested and who will be the focus of police attention. In the United States, we saw that very clearly. It wasn't high-level cartel dealers or sellers or traffickers. It was low-level, you know, arrest for possession and low-level selling.
And there was a huge impact in terms of the rates of incarceration for women. Women are impacted in a very particular way by these type of policies. Can you tell
That's
us a bit
right.
more about that?
Yeah, it's been very interesting to me. Over the last 30 years, there's been a tripling of the female prison population in the United States, in Britain, and now in Canada. And most of that increase has been due to drug offenses. And when we look at who's in prison, of course, there's way more men in prison. But percentage-wise, more women are sent to prison for drug offenses than men are. And I find this amazing because when you look at drug use stats and when you look at who's participating in the drug trade, it's overwhelmingly more men who are participants in those activities. And so we see across the board that women as well are sentenced for longer for drug offenses than men are. When we break down statistically, it's a couple of more months that they receive. And I think this definitely has to do with our attitudes about women. We're, with men still, we give them a little leeway to behave in ways that, you know, maybe are not so acceptable in society. But when women break the law, and when they break sort of gender role stereotypes, they are punished, you know, in ways that men aren't. And we see that then in our prison population in relation to women there. And we also see quite a large percentage of women in prison who are there for very long prison sentences because of importing or exporting drugs. And so sometimes women who are not from Canada, you know, who may not be familiar with the criminal justice system, very far away from home, at the very bottom of the drug trade, you know, carrying drugs on them, you know, from a growing country to Canada, or a production country to Canada, and being arrested and then serving time in our prisons. And it's difficult. I mean, most of the women in prison, as I'm sure you've talked about on your show, the large majority are mothers, and so they're not only separated from their families, but their children, too. So the cost of that to society, in relation to who is going to be caring for those children. And what we see as well in prison is that for women and men to a large degree, too, that many of them have had problematic drug use in their past. And, you know, the question you could ask is prison the place for them to be? You know, it's very expensive to be in prison, but people are not getting the care and the services that they might possibly need. So you have to ask, why would prison be the entry point for drug treatment or other issues? You know, why can't we provide those services outside the prison system?
And you mentioned this whole issue of women as mothers and drug use.
Yes.
How does that play a part of the picture? And I think also connected to the larger tough on crime agenda, and there's sort of a moral ideological backing to that I think impacts women's role in society and then how that connects to drug policy.
Yes, starting in the 1960s, and you know, even before that, there had been moments in history when there was concern about women using drugs, because women are supposed to be, you know, ideologically more virtuous than men, and sort of the our barometer of white civilization. You know, so when they're deviant, you know, it's sort of the end of civilization as we know it, is sort of how it is viewed by certain politicians and moral reformers. But we saw starting in the 1980s, there was the crack scare in the United States, and all of a sudden terminology like crack baby, crack mom became sort of, you know, headliners on newspaper reports and became common language. And people just assumed that what they heard about maternal cocaine use was accurate. So we're told these babies would have long-term problems, that the mothers were only interested in their drugs and not in caring for themselves during their pregnancy or taking care of their children afterwards. And so there was a sort of a belief system that illegal drug use equaled poor parenting and damage to the fetus. Now we know that a lot of those early studies were completely flawed, and really the number one problem related that impacts pregnancies in a very negative way is poverty and lack of maternal care. But at the time, there was a number of laws were passed. There were started to be women being arrested in the United States. Over, I guess, up to date now, over 300 women have been arrested for maternal drug use using legal statutes like trafficking to the fetus and manslaughter, assault with a deadly weapon. So women who possibly went to the hospital for their labor hadn't had any sort of maternal care in the 9 months of their pregnancy, and then given a urine analysis at the hospital, and if that was positive for illegal drug use, then they were charged with these types of offenses. And so this is going on in the United States. At the same time, there seemed to be this shift towards women where once before there, you know, might have been some argument that there was some leniency related to their drug use or their movement through the criminal justice system. We've seen a complete about face where women are now just seen as if they're participating in any criminal activity or what's considered to be deviant, they're viewed as even more deviant than their male counterparts. And so it's a very difficult situation for women, I think, especially with a lot of the misinformation about maternal drug use and misinformation about women's responsibilities to their children. And I found it quite interesting that this harsher view of women started to expand or grow or become commonplace in North American society, at the same time as we were stripping social services for women, you know, welfare as we know it, you know, cutbacks in every province and in states as well, and then blaming mothers for the outcome of their pregnancy or for the outcome of their parenting without providing them with support. So their drug use seemed to become sort of the societal ill that we could blame everything on. And luckily, there's a bit of a shift away from that right now, only in the sense that a lot of good research has been done that's exposed those early studies demonstrating that, you know, children who are exposed to drugs are not necessarily going to have a lifetime problems, and that programs that offer social supports for women, good maternal care, those mothers going through those programs who have used illegal drugs or methadone are having the same outcome, maternal outcomes, as non-drug using women. So we really see the impact of poverty and maternal care.
And I imagine that race and racialization plays a part in this whole picture.
Yes, and that's what's so interesting about this, and you know, so damaging, is that from the inception of our drug laws in the early 1900s, we saw right away that it was a very racialized policy. You know, in the beginning, it was concern about Chinese Canadians smoking of opium and fears about them introducing men and women to this drug. Well, it's continued on in that vein, and so what we see in our prisons and people who are arrested, that it's not only the poor that are arrested, that it's racialized population, First Nations, Black, people in Canada, are overrepresented in terms of drug arrests and imprisonment. And we see the same thing in the United States with Black and Latino populations being overrepresented in drug arrests and in prison populations. And interesting, I think what happens for women, too, is that racial inequality really plays havoc in the sense for women as well, because men are regulated by the law. I don't want to in any way underestimate the suffering that they undergo, you know, in relation to our drug offenses. But for women, there's a regulation going on in relation to the medical profession around their pregnancies, social services around their mothering, because most people, single parents who are on welfare, are single mothers. And then there's also the regulation of the criminal justice system. And those three professions, you know, their regulation of women really overlaps. So if a woman goes to the hospital and the nurses there feel, you know, that they see any signs of drug use, or if someone knows that she's a known drug user, well, they're going to contact social services. And so it's a whole realm of regulation that men are not experiencing, per se, around their drug use. And for women, to have their children apprehended can be a lifelong sentence. You know, you may imprison someone for 2 years, and that's a terrible thing to happen in their lives and really tears the family apart and communities. But for many women, they've had their children permanently apprehended, and so that child, you know, no longer has the care of that family, and that mother no longer has, you know, access to her child. So I think the dynamics are quite different for men and women, and, you know, we see as well that when women are sentenced to prison, that most often her social supports just disappear. If she had a partner before she went to prison, you know, within a couple of years, even months, that partner disappears. But in reverse, you know, women are actually, you know, and mothers, when their sons go to prison, are pretty faithful in terms of visiting and keeping in touch and supporting male prisoners. So we have a real, you know, different way of dealing with men and women in society.
I know in other parts of the world, communities and governments are using more humane and effective ways to deal with issues presented by drugs. Can you tell us about an example or two you think might be able to work here in Canada, something that's inspiring?
Yes, I think, you know, the Latin American countries now are really talking strongly about a regulated legal market, you know, trying to move towards that. And they've decriminalized things like the chewing of coca leaf, you know, because for the UN and the United States, any form of drug that's criminalized, whether it be the coca leaf or refined cocaine, you know, they see it as being similar. But Latin American countries are taking a look at this sort of American-driven drug war that's been going on for a long time and just saying, no, you know, we don't want to participate in this. And so having large discussions about shifting drug policy. But we've also seen places like the Netherlands that has coffee shops where you can go in and smoke marijuana and not have to worry about being arrested by the police. And in Portugal, they've decriminalized possession of drugs, and they've, you know, they're diverting then resources to the police to deal with, you know, more serious crimes than drugs, and they're opening up drug treatment for people who need that, and they feel it's a huge success. And the other thing that's been going on that I think is quite positive is in the 1990s, actually, Dr. Mary Hepburn in Glasgow in Scotland opened up one of the first health services for women, and she was actually only trying to target poor women, but she noticed that some women were using both legal and illegal drugs and set up women-centered harm reduction maternity services for women, where apprehension wasn't the first sort of response to women, and where they provided amazing maternity care and social supports, housing, and connected them with social services. And what they found with their maternal outcomes were similar to women who don't use illegal drugs. They had amazing maternal outcomes and less incidence of what we call neonatal abstinence syndrome or withdrawal symptoms. And so we've actually created a program like that in Vancouver. It's at Women's Hospital. It's called First Square. And it's our first in-hospital, women-centered harm reduction maternity program. And it's an amazing program, and some great health advocates champion, you know, for that program for a number of years. But it opened in 2003. And so the hope is that we could have more of that, because instead of being punitive towards women, it's to recognize that there's ways to make for a positive pregnancy, better maternal outcomes, and to provide the supports that women need during their pregnancies.
Yeah, I was just going to say, yeah, let's hope that there's more of those types of initiatives and programs, and also that somehow Bill C-15 doesn't pass. But we've run out of time, so I'll have to leave it there. But it's been really great to get into some of these issues and talk a little bit more about the impacts of these drug policies on women. So thanks for joining us, Susan.
Well, thank you for having me here.
Susan Boyd is an activist, researcher, and writer on drug policy, and you can find more info about Bill C-15 as well as progressive drug policy on her website. It's www.educatingharper.com. She's also working on a collective book called Raise Shit, The Fight for Insight and Social Justice Movement for a Change in Drug Policy, and it's due out this fall from Fernwood Publishing.